This Week in Parasitism is brought to you by the American Society for Microbiology at microbeworld.org/twip. This Week in Parasitism, episode number 15, recorded on August 16th, 2010. Hello, everybody. I'm Vincent Racaniello, and I'm with Dixon Despommiers.
Hello, Vince.
How you doing, Dixon?
I'm doing very well, Vince.
The parasitologist extraordinaire.
If you say so.
Absolutely. There's no finer.
Well, I believe that's true, but that has nothing to do with whether I'm a parasitologist or not, I hope.
I'm honored to inform the world about parasites in your presence.
Thank you, Vince. I'm flattered. And I'm also honored to be part of your show, This Week in Virology, which is another aspect of parasitism at a smaller level.
Is. These two shows feed one another because they're all parasites and you can learn from different systems,
no
right?
No question about
now,
it.
Now, the last time we talked about leishmania.
We did.
Or leishmania.
Right.
Depending on your bent.
Exactly.
I actually listened to it in the car the other day.
Ah, how did we sound?
Wonderful. I liked it very much.
Cool.
There was one thing we forgot to address, but I forgot what it was.
You mean a connection with leishmaniasis and Alzheimer's disease?
Yeah, perhaps. What are we doing today?
Today we're going to trip the light fantastic.
Oh, what a title.
I think we should put that as the title then,
trip,
shouldn't
we? TRYP.
Yeah.
The light.
Yes.
Fantastic.
That's right. We're going to talk about trypanosomes. More members of the same group called kinetoplastidae.
These are protozoan
they
parasites.
Are. They certainly are. They're
unicellular.
That's what protozoan means.
I bet they have flagella.
They do. A single flagellum.
Which they get rid of at some point, like the leishmanias?
Some do and some don't.
Some do. So there's more than one trypanosome.
There are more than one trypanosome.
I can think of many things to talk about.
Sure.
With respect to trypanosomes.
Okay.
Did you know for many years I heard about trypanosomes quite frequently?
I think you're going to tell us why is that true.
My wife did a postdoc in a laboratory working on trypanosomes.
Great.
George Cross's laboratory.
Sure. Very famous parasitologist over at Rockefeller University.
As a consequence, on a regular basis, I heard all about trypanosomes.
Terrific.
And antigenic variation.
Yep. We're going to hear more about that today. In fact, I here at Columbia University collaborated with another famous protozoologist, parasitologist by the name of Lex van der Ploeg.
Did he work on trips also? I believe so, right?
He worked in Holland. He certainly did with Piet Borst and did some wonderful work with him and then came here and continued his work on the variant antigen gene system, which is a very complex system. But I learned a lot just by sitting around listening.
Yeah. You can absorb quite a bit.
This is true.
By sitting in the presence of greatness.
Here.
Which is what I'm doing.
Stop it. Stop. Come on, Vince. I hope you're going to cut this part of it out. Stop. Just stop right there.
I don't like being praised. Yeah, I don't
know.
No,
I don't mind being praised for things that I do well, including communicating.
You're a great fisherman.
Oh, thank you. I'll take that one.
So I can think of a number of questions to ask you.
Okay.
Where did this name come from? Who discovered it? When and where and why and how many are there? And what do they do? What do they look like? Okay, you can start wherever you want. You are the master educator.
Well, what I would like to do, because there might be a lot of people out there that have either heard about sleeping sickness, but have not thought much about the... Thank you, Vince.
Does it really make you go to sleep?
A lot of my students actually caught that disease while I was lecturing. I was frequent to point it out to the other students who were still awake. It says, sleeping sickness. Well, there's a good example of one right in the first row.
We probably shouldn't make light of it.
Not really, because it's not actually sleeping sickness. It's not a sleeping sickness. It's a comatose sleep sickness.
Okay.
This is a disease that actually puts you into a coma. And then you probably end up dying from something else, like pneumonia or something else, that takes advantage of somebody who's not moving.
Mm. And so, it's a coma that... from which you do not awaken.
Without drugs, you will not awaken from this coma. That's correct.
Okay. I feel we're jumping the gun, though.
We are, because what I wanted to do is make the connection between last week's topic and this week's topic, because this group is known as the kinetoplastidae, and they're known as the kinetoplastidae for a good reason, because they all have kinetoplasts.
What is a kinetoplast?
That's a very good question, Vince. That's the best question to start
with. So leishmanias are also kinetoplastidae.
They are.
Okay.
And leishmania have flagella, as you will recall, only in their insect vector host. Okay? So the insect vector, which harbors the infectious stages for humans or for animals, contains a flagellated stage called the promastigote.
Right.
Remember?
I do.
And that's going to be true for this group as well, because they're all vector-borne diseases, except one. Trypanosome called Trypanosoma equipertum, which infects horses. Mm-hmm. It's not vector-borne, Vince. Take a guess how the horses catch it.
Horse flies.
That's a vector.
I know. I'm sorry. Just
that's
a silly
okay.
joke.
They catch
how
it.
Do they get it? Wait. Do they rub against each other?
Yeah, they have to get it. Yes. That's the first step in this transmission cycle is that they have to come in contact.
Mm. Is this sexually transmitted?
It is. It's
among
sexual,
horses.
It is.
I don't know of any microbes that are sexually transmitted among horses. Do you know of others?
I don't know much about horses, Vince. But
neither do I.
I know that usually parasites that have common features, like flagellae and insect vectors and kinetoplasts, and they share similar genetic material, they usually are transmitted in similar ways. But here's one big exception. It's transmitted by sexual contact.
Well, whatever is evolutionarily selected for works, right?
Precisely right.
So in the horse?
Yep.
But it's interesting because is this a disease of modern horses or has it been around a long time?
That's a great question because horses, as you know, start out as tiny little four-legged animals.
Right.
In fact, in North America, that's where they originated. Go ahead.
So, no, I was going to say then they become big four-legged.
Yeah, that's right. They evolved into larger plains animals, grass eaters, and then spread throughout Europe and Asia. Mm-hmm. But in Africa, that's interesting, right? I mean, this is an African disease, basically what we're going to talk about in terms of sleeping sickness.
What about the equipertum? What's the distribution?
I don't actually know much about that disease. I think veterinarians know more about that than I do. But
the reason I'm asking is because at one point, before we domesticated horses, they were just running around wild.
There's a lot of wild horses now, too.
Right.
Tons of them.
I would think a sexually transmitted disease would be difficult to establish because they are
nomadic.
They don't they have sex to reproduce, but it's not frequent.
Understood.
You know, the gestation period is probably at least a year for a horse, right?
Right.
I hope the vets are not going to jump on me.
It reminds me of a joke. A guy goes to his doctor, and the doctor says, "Well, how are things, Al?" And Al says, "Oh, they're just fine, except for my sexual encounters with my wife." And the doctor says, "Well, is it infrequent?" He says, you mean that as a noun or a verb?" 2, 3, 4. Okay, we're going to go back to our main subject here, friends. The main subject is trypanosome.
So we don't know the answer if it's a modern disease of horses or an ancient one.
There are, I don't know how you would check to the ancient one because protozoans usually don't leave fossil records, but they might leave some pathological evidence that you might take as a presence or absence.
Discovered in 1901.
Yeah. So, most of the trypanosomes were discovered at the turn of the century as the result of the improvement of the microscope, the improvement of staining technologies, as we mentioned before, with malaria, and the interest in infectious diseases. And this one, Trypanosoma brucei, and it's named... It's got several variants to it, Trypanosoma brucei gambiense and Trypanosoma brucei rhodesiense, which is an older name for a new country, Zimbabwe, was named by one individual.
Bruce.
Yeah. And
his last name was Bruce?
Yep.
Turn of the century, roughly. What country?
Well, he's Scotland, and he began to approach this infection from a completely different perspective. He was seeking the causative agent for spontaneous abortion in cattle. And he found it. Okay, but along the way, he encountered this other disease.
Is that brucellosis?
It is, actually.
Bruce, the same Bruce.
No, Vince, you're so smart.
Are you serious? I didn't make
it. You're
ever.
A riot. Brucellosis, named after, well, I guess he named it after himself.
Wow.
I kept saying that I would much rather have a cure named after me than a disease, but that's the way it is.
It's a bacterium, right?
That's correct. That's right.
Kind of bacterium.
What kind of bacterium causes brucellosis?
Mm-hmm.
Brucella abortus. The name of the bacterium is Brucella abortus.
You're right. Wow, this fellow was active.
He was very active, but for 20 years, he started out working, I believe it was on the island of Malta, and worked his way into mainland Africa. And when he encountered a disease in cattle, which also caused abortions, he didn't find the same organism. He found another organism. This was European cattle only, by the way. There were some native Ndama cattle that lived in West Africa that were not affected by this particular agent. But he worked mostly in East Africa. And in East Africa, there was a very powerful disease of European cattle, particularly in Kenya and places like that, where European settlements began. And they were having a very difficult time keeping their cows alive. And they were all dying from an unknown disease, not from brucellosis, which doesn't ordinarily kill adult animals, but rather from a disease that perhaps was transmitted by flies, okay, because there were lots of flies in the area. And as it turns out, through the history of investigating this infection, Bruce determined that indeed there was a trypanosome which was associated with the infectious disease presented by the cattle, and that he could isolate this parasite, as he called it, from game animals. And then finally, when he started to look around to see what other organisms might transmit this, I don't believe he was the one that discovered the tsetse fly as the agent of transmission, because I think somebody else got credit for that. But the fact is that it turns out to be a vector-borne disease in both West and East Africa, carried by a group of organisms, which we commonly call tsetse flies.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but their real name is Glossina, Glossina this, Glossina that, and they've got very, very restricted zones as to where they might live. There's a big map. WHO has some very nice literature on this. In fact, my website on medical ecology has a whole section on trypanosomiasis, and you can actually go there and look at the distribution of the Glossina and see where they're found.
What was the disease like in cattle?
Well, I mean, it was called Nagana, N-A-G-A-N-A. That's exactly what Bruce named it. And the disease in cattle was the cattle started to exhibit wasting-like syndrome.
I see.
And they started to become lethargic, and they didn't move well, and they didn't go to water like they should, and that sort of thing. And the next thing you know, they were laying down, and the next thing you know, they were dead.
So it spread among cattle.
That's correct.
How big is a tsetse fly?
It's about the size of a house fly.
Not very big.
Not very big. Not very noticeable. And so we're jumping a little bit ahead of the story, though. So on the one hand, you have Trypanosoma brucei group of parasites found mostly in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, only in Africa. And then you have another group of parasites called trypanosomes. Trypanosoma cruzi.
C-R-U.
Z-I.
Z-I.
Named after Oswaldo Cruz, who was a very famous parasitologist in South America. And he was the one, by the way, as I mentioned in my segment on toxoplasmosis, who was looking for the causative agent for Chagas disease, which later on was named after Carlos Chagas, and found instead the causative agent for, we're having a senior moment here.
Wait a minute.
Because I'm trying to jump ship, trying to go from one trypanosome to the next. Toxoplasmosis is what I meant to say. So he first of all discovered the causative agent for toxoplasmosis and then discovered the causative agent for South American, or what they call American trypanosomes.
Which is Chagas disease.
Which we call Chagas disease.
Caused by T. cruzi.
Correct.
And this is exclusively found
in South America. Central America and some parts of Mexico and the United States.
Texas.
That's right.
Wow.
animals, right? So it's also vector-borne, but it doesn't rely on flies. It relies on bugs. Now you say, everybody calls insects bugs, but there are true bugs.
An insect is not a bug.
An insect, let's go backwards. Bugs are insects. All bugs are insects, but not all insects are bugs.
Okay. What does a bug look like?
A bug, well, if people in New York City were to be asked that question, they could easily tell you because everybody's got bed bugs right now. So they can honestly describe what a bed bug looks like. It has a large piercing mouth part that it tucks up underneath its body. They're usually flat dorsoventrally, and they're a little spherical in shape.
Okay, how many legs? They
got six legs and insects. All insects have six legs.
All insects have six.
Every one of them.
The six legs.
Six legs. Arthropods. We can keep doing this.
Wait a minute. Arthropods.
Some arthropods have eight legs. What would you call those?
Spiders.
Arachnids.
Arachnids.
These are insects. These
Arachnophobia.
That's right. And then you have decapodia. You have crabs and crustaceans.
Crabs are arthropods.
They are. We've gone through this already.
I know, but I can't remember any of it.
Jointed legs. Arthropods.
A bug transmits Chagas disease.
So a bug, a series of bugs, transmits Chagas disease. They're called reduvid bugs.
Reduvid.
Or the kissing bugs. Because
are they big?
They're very large. Vince, they're 1.5 inches, 2 inches long. They're huge.
So here's what I remember. I had a postdoc from Argentina where they have Chagas disease.
They sure do.
He says people sleeping in houses with mud roofs, the bugs would fall on their face at night and bite them. Can you imagine?
Correct. In fact, Charlie Darwin was eaten alive by them when he first came to the New World and started to explore throughout South America. The first night that he spent in a hut with natives on the other side of the Andes, as he crawled over them to see where they might go, was absolutely inundated with bites from reduvid bugs. And that spawned a myth that perhaps a lot of his troubles were caused by Chagas disease, but it turned out not to be true.
So is it safe to say that the two species are restricted by their vectors, the African and the South American?
They sure are. And neither the twain shall meet. There are no tsetse flies in the New World, and there are no reduvid bugs in the Old World. But it's interesting, Vince, when you look at continental drift and you look at evolution, how long ago do you have to go back before these were connected?
A long time.
Before the Jurassic era.
Yeah.
Okay. At the Jurassic era, they started to pull apart. And that's where the dinosaurs started to differ in both places, too. Right? But you had trypanosomes that must have infected dinosaurs. And that's why I said that, because these must have been dinosaur parasites to begin with. And then what you've got here is a drift of continents separating the two trypanosomes from each other and the groups of dinosaurs. As evolution proceeded in different directions, they took advantage of different selective pressures.
Sure.
You had tsetse flies that arose in Africa and reduvid bugs that arose in South America and Central America to take advantage of this.
So there are reduvids in South America, Central America, and parts of the southern U.S. We have reduvids?
We do.
Really?
We actually do.
So where do these bugs or flies get the trypanosomes from?
From an infected individual.
Okay.
Just like the mosquitoes get it from their victims for malaria. And there's a complicated set of developmental stages that occurs inside of the tsetse fly or the reduvid bug, all related to receptors and ligands and receptors that develop along the surface of the trypanosomes as they develop towards their infectious stage. When they're ingested, each one of them transforms into a flagellated form that doesn't look anything like the infectious stage that eventually ends up getting into the next host. And it takes a couple of days to weeks for these things to transform into their infectious stages. In the reduvid bug, the transformation is linear. That is to say, it's sucked up through this biting mouth part. And as it develops into the next stage, it develops a new surface coat. And it allows it to attach at various spots along the gut tract of the reduvid bug until finally it ends up only being able to attach to the very end of the gut tract, in the anal area of the gut tract. That's how it's transmitted. You'd think the reduvid bug sucks blood, injects the parasites, pulls away, and you've got the infection. But that's not how it occurs.
It defecates on you.
It does.
And it's also biting you.
Yeah.
So that these parasites get in. the wound that the bug makes. That's terrible.
You know this. You know this. I don't know how you know this, but you do. That was an intuitive guess.
Well, it makes sense if it's pooping it out that it should be biting and...
Can you imagine such a greedy bug that it sucks up blood and to make room for it, it actually defecates out what's in its gut tract to make room for it?
So is that the same for the tsetse fly as well?
No, not at all.
Totally different.
It's totally different. It's totally different.
So
the tsetse fly actually injects the parasites.
Doesn't defecate them.
Through its mouth.
More like the mosquito vectors.
That's correct.
So
here we have these two complete... Wait, there's more differences that I want to talk about too, because before we discuss either one, we have to discuss how these parasites carry out their life cycles in general.
Yes.
In Africa, the trypanosomes are all extracellular dividing parasites.
The African trypanosomes are extracellular.
Correct. None of them become intracellular at any point in their life cycle.
All right.
That's very unusual. Why? Because if you go to South America and Central America and look at Trypanosoma cruzi, and by the way, as far as I know, there's only one species of trypanosome that infects humans in South and Central America.
The T. cruzi.
Yes. There are other look-alike parasites. Mm-hmm. That infect other animals that we think perhaps might, if we encounter them, induce some partial immunity because we don't become diseased. Rather, we just become infected, and then our immune system fights it off. But in the American form of trypanosomiasis in humans, as compared to the African trypanosomes in humans, the African trypanosomes circulate in blood and in lymph, but never become intracellular. In the American trypanosome, the trypanosome actually penetrates a cell, loses its flagellum, gets incorporated into the parasitophorus vacuole, then just crawls out of it, disappears into the cytoplasm to become sort of another organelle. And as the result of that, the secretion of hydrogen to acidify the parasitophorus vacuole so the lysosomal enzymes can work is totally disarmed by this parasite's escape route out into the cytoplasm, naked cytoplasm, where it then begins to divide.
Hmm. These are the South American ones?
The American ones. We'll just call it the American because it's Central America.
They're
as well
intracellular.
They are obligate intracellular parasites in their hosts, not the definitive host, although you could say, well, gee, Dick, do these trypanosomes engage in sexual activity? And the answer is, we think they do.
Hmm.
There's some evidence now that there's genomic exchange. Yeah, so Vince, the Trypanosoma cruzi and its relatives in this part of the world where we are, once they get into a mammalian host, and they get into a lot of mammalian hosts, by the way, this is a promiscuous parasite. Trypanosoma cruzi infects almost all of the mammals of South America. And South America has the most diverse array of mammals in the world.
Oh, not just people.
Not just people.
Wow.
Oh, no, no. So it's all over the place.
So there are reservoirs and definitive hosts?
Well, when I say definitive, remember, it has to be a sexual stage to this, right?
Do we have sexual stages?
We're not sure. We're not sure. It's still up in the air as to whether or not there is, but there's some evidence of recombination.
In which host?
In the reduvid bug.
Ah. But right. Not in
that's where malaria animals. Takes place, right? Yeah,
interesting.
That's right. So, okay. So
many different animals, that's where the reduvids pick up.
That's correct.
The trypanosomes.
It infects dogs and cats and
cattle. There was a picture of
everything gets
this
infected.
This impala, one of the many reservoirs.
I took that picture.
You took a picture of an impala?
I did, but we're looking at the African trypanosomes here.
Sorry.
That's okay.
But the American also infect all kinds of animals.
They do. They have so many different reservoir hosts that you couldn't possibly list them.
You don't have any pictures of
none, because there are too many.
But in Africa, there aren't that many mammals.
Well, we'll get to that. We'll get to that.
Okay.
We'll
get to that. Okay, go ahead.
So, what if Trypanosoma cruzi escapes from the host by crawling into naked cytoplasm?
Yes.
Then how does the African trypanosome escape from its host, because it doesn't crawl into cytoplasm? It's in blood. And blood is the place, of course, for the exchange of antigens and antibody formation and the simulation of B cells. You get messages to the lymph nodes and bone marrow and thymocytes and all kinds of wonderful things going with the immune system. which reacts against foreigners, as this is.
So it's not intracellular.
It's not intracellular, so it's totally bathed in your serum,
mm-hmm.
which means, of course, that if you mount an antibody response against it, you're going to kill them. And in fact, you do. But you don't kill them all. You only kill about 99.9999%. That's not enough. Can you imagine somebody telling you that, like your boss? You know, Dr. Recognello, that was a wonderful job, but you only did 99.9999% of the job. You didn't finish it. You naughty boy.
So you're not going to be paid.
You're not going to be. Oh, I dock your pay. You've got 10% off. Report to me on Sunday or don't show up for work on Monday. Imagine being told that.
Amazing.
You wouldn't accept that as a standard.
No.
Come on, 90% is good.
I'd say, well, you can dock 0.0001% of my pay. Sure, I'm going home.
Exactly. Well, unfortunately, here's what happens when you do that from an antibody perspective. The 0.0001% of the trypanosomes grow up to replace the ones that you just killed, becoming the 100% now that you now have to kill again.
And they are resistant to the antibodies you have, right?
They are, because they're totally different. So we're jumping a little bit ahead of the story here, because we're getting into the molecular mechanisms for escape.
All right, let's not.
But both of these trypanosomes evolved from a common ancestor, we think, and then diverged after the continents drifted to take up two completely different ecological settings.
The intracellular parasites, the American ones,
yes.
The Cruzeyes,
yes.
Do not vary antigenically?
You should never say that. Exactly right.
But I think since they're intracellular, they wouldn't be subject.
That's not how you kill them off, all right? You don't kill them by reacting against their surface coat proteins like you do for the trypanosomes in Africa.
Okay.
So I just wanted to start off with saying that, but you don't find trypanosomiasis in too many other places, by the way.
Not Southeast Asia,
nope.
China.
Nope. Whereas Leishmaniasis is all over the place.
And so is T. gondii.
That's right.
Toxoplasma.
Oh, that's everywhere.
So by your standards, trypanosomes are not terribly successful.
Well, they are where they live. They have a very good local success. In South America, we haven't finished talking about their range of hosts, because in South America, all mammalian species are susceptible to T. cruzi.
How about frogs?
Mammalian species.
And non-mammalian don't work?
Non-mammalian don't work.
Okay.
So just mammals, but that's quite an array.
The bugs do.
Oh, yeah.
Bugs and mammals.
That's right. In Africa, you've got a schism going on here, a really interesting schism, which drove Bruce crazy.
Have a division?
You do. One's called East African trypanosomiasis. The other's called West African trypanosomiasis. Now, in West Africa, there are very, very, very few reservoir host species.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is the domestic pig, believe it or not.
Domestic pig.
The domestic pig. It'll infect cattle also and people, but it rarely, if ever, probably never, infects the game animals.
Mm-hmm.
They got the same gamut of animals, Vince. They've got giraffes, they've got zebras, they've got lions.
As Eastern.
Exactly the same.
But they're not infected.
They don't have any gnus.
T. trypanosomes.
They don't have any gnus.
I gnu that.
You gnu that? Did you know that gnu dung spelled backwards is the same as
no,
gnu dung
now
spelled
I do.
Forwards? It's a palindrome. So we have this interesting division.
So there's a new. There's a gnu in both the East and the West?
No, there's no gnus in the West. Gnus are in East Africa only.
And in the East, is it infected by T. brucei?
Yes. All of the game animals of East Africa, including gnus, and that's a wildebeest, including gazelles, Thompson's gazelles. I could name a whole bunch of them. Dik-diks and Gerenuks and all these other exotic Eastern African animals are all infected, but they do not get sick.
But they serve as reservoirs, though.
They are. You can call them reservoirs, but before we came along, all right, it was still an infection of people, too. And that may be why we sought out areas of Africa to develop in, which had nothing to do with the transmission of this infection, all right? When we arose as a species out of Africa, we hightailed it out of that place, and we actually went south. up into Namibia.
You think it was T. Brucey that did it?
No, you know, there's a lot of theories as to why we did migrate. But one of the best ones that I like revolves around the fact that the hyena evolved in Eurasia, not in Africa, and migrated to Africa during one of the ice ages. That's when we were arising in Africa. And we had the pick of all the bones. Okay, we could afford to let all those large predator species eat those game animals right down to the bone. As long as they left the bones, we were still okay. Because when they left, because there's no more meat, we would run out onto the plains from the trees in the little shrubs that we were hiding in, crack open the long bones, suck out the marrow, and get a good protein fix, which gave us a big jump in our own evolution, because the more protein you eat, apparently, the faster your brains evolve. That's another hypothesis, but certainly one that seems to fit the data.
Yeah.
The point is that when the hyena arrived on the scene, it wanted the bones.
The hyenas crack open the long bones.
Boy, do they. They've got the strongest jaws in the world. They can even eat elephant bones and hippo bones. They can finish off a whole carcass. That's remarkable. They don't have to be hunters. That's not even scavenging. They're like... I don't know what you'd call them, but they eat a lot of bones, okay? So around the Horn of Africa, we go, hightailing it out of that zone so that we didn't have to compete with the hyenas because the hyenas will kill us, right? I mean, they're dangerous animals.
Yeah.
And if they want that carcass, you better leave them alone. Otherwise, they'll eat your bones too. So here we are, holed up in South Africa for about maybe 20 to 50,000 years. Then another ice age comes along. And the lower the water gets around Africa, the more likely it is that we can walk along the beaches and pick up dead fish and all that stuff that we could collect without having to worry about encountering hyenas. And out of Africa we go, and the rest is history, right? So that's kind of a snapshot view of the difference between Trypanosoma rhodesiens and gambiens, that's in Africa, and Trypanosoma cruzi in South America. But we still don't understand much about the differences between Trypanosoma brucei rhodesiense and Trypanosoma brucei gambiense. They're morphologically identical, Vince. They're morphologically identical.
Well,
but apparently...
Morphology ain't everything.
No, it ain't. One of them is affected by apolipoprotein.
Affected in what way?
Badly.
Uh-huh.
So if you have apolipoprotein elevation in your blood... you're going to knock off the trypanosome. You're not susceptible. And apparently, only one of the two species of trypanosomes is susceptible to that mode of operation.
Which one?
The one in West Africa, rather.
Okay.
And that probably explains the difference between the susceptibility of the game animals in one side of Africa to the other.
So is that Gambiense and Rhodesiense? Yeah. Those are the east and west, or west or east?
Well, the Gambia is in West Africa.
So that's the western species.
Yeah, and Rhodesia, which it used to be called, actually named after Rhodes, a Dutchman, is in East Africa.
So these both cause similar diseases.
They do in people. They both cause similar diseases, but one is a fulminating, fast, terrible disease, that's West Africa. The other one is a slow, protracted, lethargic sleeping sickness. That's East Africa.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They say in West Africa you die from the trypanosome, and in East Africa you die with the trypanosome. But you're still going to die if you don't get treated.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's do the African trypanosomes first.
We might have to do two episodes. African may occupy the rest, but we'll see.
Okay, so let's begin.
Where are we beginning?
With a life cycle, of course.
Okay.
And once you've understood the life cycle, then you can begin to understand the ecology of this infection. So we begin with the tsetse flies, okay? And there are Glossina tsetse flies. Glossina is... tremendous group of dipterans. They got two wings. All right?
Two wings, two dipterans.
Diptera, dipatura.
Patura.
Right.
I learned so much.
So mosquitoes are dipterans also, by the way. They actually have four pairs of wings, but we don't even see the other pair because they're called halteres.
Mm.
And they're tiny little things that stick out in the back of the two wings, and they almost serve as rudders for the bigger wings.
Okay. Dixon B., how did you get to know so much about insects? Because parasites depend on them so much?
If you look in the back of our book, you'll see about one quarter of our book is devoted to medical entomology. And that whole section was written by a very good friend of mine, Robert Guatz, who's at the NIH and studies malaria primarily. But he's a very, very well-versed medical entomologist. He and I both got our degrees at the University of Notre Dame together.
Did you meet? You met him there?
We met there. We met there. And he was invited on board to write this section of the book, and he continues to do it every year. And for many, many years, we taught together here at Columbia, and he used to give the medical entomology lecture. And I just sat there in awe. Every year, he would throw up similar but different slides as the subjects evolved over a 30-year period. I guess they should.
Wow. This is quite impressive.
It's very impressive. And
the arthropods.
That's it.
So within arthropods are insects.
Insects and arachnids. Those are the two groups that we discussed.
Where are the crabs?
Crabs are crustaceans.
They're not arthropods?
Well, they are arthropods. Of course they are.
What is an arthropod?
It's a jointed-legged critter with an exoskeleton.
So it has a broad umbrella, basically.
It's tremendously broad.
So it's got, we have insects, we have spiders who are arthropods, we have crustaceans who are arthropods. Who else?
That's right.
Am I an arthropod?
No. Scorpions?
Scorpions.
Those are arthropods. Are you an arthropod?
I was kidding.
No, you could be an orthopod. We call those orthopods here in orthopedics.
Wow, this is very nice.
It is nice. And it's a synopsis. I mean, there are enormous books on this subject that you can find out there. And but they're boring in some ways because they contain too much detail. They're good reference texts, but they don't make for fascinating reading.
All right.
Whereas this, you know, it's a quick look at the medical entomology world. So they play a big role in this subject, though. So here we have tsetse flies flying around. And let's say it's an infected tsetse fly. And
what does that mean?
That means that they're infected with the trypanosomes.
Which form?
Either T. brucei or T. brucei.
I mean, what morphological form?
Ah, that's a good question. So they're called metacyclic trypanosomes. Metacyclic.
So is this what I would think of when I visualize a trypanosome, this undulating?
Yes. It has a kinetoplast. It has a large nucleus.
Metacyclic trypanomastigote?
Trypomastigote. Metacyclic trypomastigote is its official name.
So it's kind of...
that's the infectious form.
How would we describe this? Well, we can show a picture on the website, but it's kind of like, it's a beautiful figure 6-1 in your book, right?
Yeah.
And this has a little membrane on the back, which undulates, and then it ends in a flagellum.
That's correct. And it starts out at the kinetoplast. You asked me what the kinetoplast was, and I'm going to tell you now. The kinetoplast is a modified mitochondrion.
Kineto meaning energy or movement?
Yeah,
movement.
Kineto means movement.
So this is a body that imparts movement.
Or it's connected to the flagellum, which imparts movement.
Okay.
That's correct. And so you would equate this with energy generation. In a mitochondria, of course, that's all it's about. Right. It's a little battery almost of energy.
So this is the battery for the flagellum?
That's right.
Have you ever seen one of these swimming?
Oh, yeah.
In a microscope?
Sure.
Yeah.
Lots of times.
Is it beautiful?
It's gorgeous. A friend of mine, Philip D'Alessandro, who was my chairman at Columbia for many, many years, worked on a Trypanosoma lewisi, T. lewisi.
It's American or African?
It's an American. It's American. Well, it's found in a lot of places, and it's transmitted to rats by fleas. So it's a vector-borne infection as well.
So the fly, the tsetse, is full of these
metacyclic trypomastigotes.
Okay.
That's correct.
Full of them in the blood.
Full of them, and not in the blood. He doesn't have them in the blood. It's got them in his gut tract. And it's his salivary glands.
I'm sorry, I've forgotten. These are not the intracellular ones?
This is not the intracellular one. That's correct.
So the Africans don't go intracellular.
They do not.
So these are in his or her salivary glands.
That's correct. They both take blood meals.
And do they multiply there?
They do.
By binary fission?
By a sort of binary fission. Yes,
As you said, there might be some sexual reproduction going on.
There is some vague evidence to that effect.
All right. So the fly is full of these trypomastigotes.
Correct.
Flagellated, able to move around.
Correct.
The fly isn't full of them. It's in the salivary glands only.
That's right. And as the tsetse fly takes a blood meal and slices its way through your tissues.
Slices
yum,
and dices
yum, yum,
its way.
And then sucks out the blood, in go the trypanosomes. And then you become infected.
Does it also put in a pharmacopoeia like the mosquitoes?
Tons of it. Tons of it. Mm. Tons of it. hundreds of, no, I wouldn't say hundreds of proteins, but dozens. You know, dozens of proteins, all of which have a varying effect on your blood vessel dilation and clotting factors, etc.
This is the size of a fly.
I know.
I mean, a mosquito, okay, no see-ums.
Right, right.
But this is big. How do people let them bite? We know, as soon as a fly lands on me, I see it and bam, it's gone.
Sure, and most of the time that's what you do. And most of the time
when you're sleeping it doesn't happen?
No, no, no. This is when you're wide awake. These things actually chase after things.
Oh, they're aggressive.
Not only are they aggressive, they're following odor trails. But guess what their odor trail is?
Carbon dioxide.
And methane.
Methane.
Because they bite cattle. They bite ruminants mostly. Yeah,
cattle do a lot of methane.
So in
and
East
do
Africa.
They bite cockroaches?
No, 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 no.
They which bite make mammals. A lot of methane.
Right? No, those are termites.
Termites, sorry.
It's okay, Vince. It's okay. We're going to have you up to speed in no time here. The point is that I want to say something about the distribution of these vectors. If you divide Africa in half almost, on the west side of Africa, you have what they call riverine species of tsetse flies. They're found only along the rivers.
Here's a map of Africa.
Yeah, that's a crude map.
Well, it's an area. It's crude a satellite
map.
Photo, man.
Yeah, but it's not even a map, right?
No.
It doesn't tell you anything about where trypanosomes live. I just wanted to show you.
Well, you just said you divide a line.
You divide it in half. Okay. So it's interesting because it says the tsetse flies on one side of Africa breed only along the rivers.
Mm-hmm.
And the others breed out in the open. If you go along the rivers of West Africa, where there are more rivers than there are in East Africa, by the way, you can find thousands of tsetse flies per, let's say, 100 yards of river bank. Thousands, maybe even millions sometimes. If you go 50 yards away from the river, you don't find any. Zero.
Why?
It's where they breed. It's their ecology says we will live and breed along the rivers. They're called riverine species. If you go to East Africa, you'll find one tsetse fly per square mile. So you were saying if you swat a fly and it turns out to be a tsetse fly, and if you're in East Africa, you've just cleared a square mile of East Africa of tsetse flies. So here's what they do in East Africa, because they want to clear a lot of territory for their cattle.
Mm-hmm.
They have a jeep. Right, a Land Rover, and they're towing in the back of it an artificial cow. It's on wheels.
Mm-hmm.
It's painted up to look like a cow, in fact, and it's got an odor device on it that gives off methane and CO2,
mm-hmm.
which is totally attractive. The motion of the dummy attracts the fly's eyes, and the closer they get, they pick up the scent trail. They home right in on it. Then there's a fly trap. They are led right into the fly trap, and they're gone. Now, if you do this over, let's say, a 50-square-mile region of Africa, you can raise cattle inside of that region, and you don't have to worry about trypanosomiasis.
So this is in the east?
Yes, only.
And if you didn't do this, the cattle would suffer in what way?
They would become infected with trypanosomes.
And they don't thrive, and you can't use
them. They'll
die. They will die.
Yeah, this is the European cattle that you want to graze in, let's say, places like Kenya and...
For meat.
That's correct. That is exactly
okay.
Right.
So that is what they do. They
so that's
travel
interesting.
Around
they,
with a decoy.
They have these decoys that they use now for trapping the trypanosomes themselves. The tsetse flies.
And this is effective.
Very effective. If you try that in West Africa, you'll never succeed because you've got thousands to hundreds of thousands of flies per square mile.
Yeah.
But only along the rivers. So if you learn to live away from the rivers and you keep your cattle away from the water, wait a minute, you can't keep your cattle away from water. That's the difference between African mammals and European cattle. European cattle need water every single day.
Mm-hmm.
African animals can go many days to weeks without water. How do they do that, Vince? They make metabolic water from burning fat.
Is that right?
Yeah. Did you know that?
No, I did not.
In fact, camels do this. If you toke up a camel with as much water as they can possibly sequester, right? But also feed them. The hump develops the fat, all right? It converts all that water and hay and grass into fat and the fat is stored in the hump. Now you can go literally across the Horn of Africa on a camel without any water for the camel, because as it burns its fat, it makes water from that. For every gram of fat that you burn, you generate 1.1 grams of metabolic water. So that things like a kangaroo rat, for instance, drinks no water whatsoever. Gerenuks drink no water whatsoever. They eat, they develop fat. The fat produces the water as they burn it, and that keeps the water balancing.
And the cows obviously don't do that.
That's right. All they have to do is eat grass to start with, and then they can handle the rest metabolically. So you're right. So that's the story. So if you kept cattle away from sources of water in West Africa and brought the water to them instead, like through irrigation canals or something, you might be able to avoid trypanosomiasis.
Is that done?
Yeah. In many places it is done.
It's expensive.
It's very expensive. And raising cows for meat production is very expensive to begin with. It's a European delicacy, basically. In Africa, they live on bushmeat, a lot of that. And, of course, you know where that's where HIV came from.
Sure.
So we have some connections here with food and things like that. So, okay, so the tsetse fly now with metacyclic trypanosomes in tow bites you. And the trypanosome now goes into the interstitial spaces and begins to replicate, okay? And as it does and it replicates, it produces an ulcer. It's called an ulcer.
on the skin?
Or? Yes. On the skin. And this very, very large ulcer.
This is where you were bitten.
That's where you were bitten. And it's the initial site of the infection, but it's not where the trypanosomes actually stay. Eventually, they go into the blood, and they start to replicate in the blood.
Much time to the development of the ulcer?
A couple of weeks.
A long time after the bite.
A chanker. It's called a chanker. Mm-hmm. I meant to call it a chanker. Much the same as you get with syphilis, by the way. And as this chanker then heals, and you say, oh, I guess I'm all better, you start to develop these swellings in the back of your neck.
I see a picture of them here.
It's called winter bottom sign, actually, named after a physician who discovered this originally working in Africa. All right. So a guy by the name of Ford, by the way, at the turn of the century, discovered the pathology of this infection in people and made the connection between the animal disease, or the animal infection, rather, and the human disease.
What is this winter bottom?
Winter bottom sign is merely an immunologic response to the antigens given off by the parasite.
Why in the back of your neck?
Good question, Vince. That's a very good question. I have no idea.
So in 100 people who were bitten by a tsetse fly with metacyclic trypanosomatids, what's the word?
Good. No, you did it. That's perfect.
How many will become ill out of 100?
I think they all will.
They all will?
I think they all will. Well, it depends on the initial dose of trypanosomes that they get from the tsetse fly, but I think given a proper dose, they all become infected. Now, whether they all become sick, whether they all die, that's another question.
Okay, so with winter bottoms.
So with winter bottoms sign, it tells you that this person has African trypanosomiasis.
So that would be diagnostic, right?
It is diagnostic, but you have to also do other things to prove this. And of course, you can isolate the organisms from the blood supply, right? Or you can do a PCR test and find the, they do it for the kinetoblast to make sure that they don't pick up DNA from anything else.
All right.
Okay. So, but I was going to say that the kinetoblast has extra nuclear DNA associated with it, just like mitochondria have DNA, extra nuclear DNA associated with it. And that's why they know that these two things are probably linked and related to each other. And some other enzymes which have commonality between functional mitochondria and the kinetoblast are also found in both.
Probably came from another organism.
Exactly.
Like the mitochondria.
Lynn Margulis would have certainly agreed with that hypothesis. So the trypanosomes just start to replicate. I mean, they're just going to multiply like crazy, okay? And what do? They deplete your glucose supply, all right? They take up glucose. They have
So the winter bottom comes after the trips also get in the blood.
After the chanker develops and
disappears. Then they get into the blood?
Right.
And spread.
And at that point, your whole body, I mean, you could isolate them from your toe. If you just take blood from your toe or your finger, you can isolate the trypanosomes. Then something interesting happens. I mean, if this becomes a chronic infection, which means that you've had an antibody response, you've killed off 99.99, and then you've got another round of replication back up and then down and back up and down and back up, you get these peaks of parasitism, and each one of them is a unique antigenic signature.
Ah, so you make a lot of trips, then you have an antibody response. It brings the number down 99.999%.
You have a survival.
The survivors come up.
That's right.
And you have this oscillating disease, which you show nicely here. It's called parasitemia, up and down. Over the course of weeks.
Or even a year. It could go as long as a year.
In the meantime, what's happened to your winter bottoms?
It goes away.
So during these peaks of parasitemia, what do you feel like?
Well, worse and worse as the fever? Disease progresses. No, not much. Not much. And you're starting to generate a lot of IgM. Mm-hmm. And you're killing off a lot of parasites. So you have a lot of debris of parasites in your blood.
Are your cells being killed, any of your cells?
Not right away. No, because it's not an intracellular parasite.
All right.
So, but eventually it breaches the blood-brain barrier. And it gets into the cerebral circulation. Mm-hmm. When that happens, then some very interesting things happen. One of the hypotheses is that it secretes a compound like L-DOPA. It's a tryptophan-like molecule, which then is broken down into tryptophan. And tryptophan, as you know, puts you to sleep.
It's in turkey, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. That's right. That's right. It's the postprandial nap that everyone enjoys after Thanksgiving. So the trypanosome is thought to induce something similar to that. And at that point, the patient begins to get drowsy and lethargic and motionless, basically. Unrousable, as they would say.
Unrousable.
That's right.
How many weeks?
Could be, you know, 6 months. But every person that has it needs another person to take care of them, because you have to feed these people and you have to give them water.
So when they're unrousable, sure. You can't rouse them at all?
No, not at all. So they're unresponsive.
Can't you give them chemotherapy?
You can. Of course you can.
So why should anyone go 10 weeks with this?
Not anymore.
Undiagnosed.
Unless you can't afford the drugs. Unless you're living in the bush and unless you don't know about the drugs.
Yeah, sure.
As far as we know, there are no resistant organisms to these drugs yet. But
so there are drugs available to treat.
Sure, that's right.
And they're safe and they kill all.
Well, I wouldn't say they're safe. I wouldn't say they're safe. There are lots of toxic side effects of these drugs. Mm. Milarsoprol is one of those drugs.
Milarsoprol.
Mm. Developed by another guy at Rockefeller University, as a matter of fact. And, an old chemotherapist.
So these kill the trypanosomes. By the way, it's the same form in your blood that started off in the tsetse fly.
That's
it doesn't
correct.
Really. They don't have multiple forms as many of the other parasites that we've talked about.
That's true. That's true. I mean, it's very simple, right? You have long, slender forms and short, stumpy forms. That's the two division cycle forms that you've got. So, and because the organism undergoes antigenic variation, as it's called, there has to be at least one trypanosome that's expressing both the old protein and the new protein on its surface coat at the same time. And bingo, using very sophisticated fluorescence microscopy and very specific reagents to each of these A and B and C and D and E, and you're going to run out of alphabet before it runs out of antigens. They can produce thousands of different kinds of these antigens. You can... Through that technology, you can actually detect the single organism that's the cause of the next round of infection.
There's
quite
just
amazing.
One?
Or several, but not more.
So if you recover, say you've, would you, after a natural untreated infection, will you recover? What's the fraction? No?
It's
100% fatal?
Well, you know, there's nothing 100%, so I can't honestly give you this.
Yeah, rabies is 100%.
I don't, no, not quite.
It's close.
It's pretty close. It's pretty close.
Yeah,
it's pretty
only close. Been a handful of people who have
well,
survived.
That's the point. That's the point. But and cryotherapy here wouldn't do anything.
So it's almost 100%.
Almost
now, if
100%.
You're treated with drugs that clear the infection, do they clear it actually?
They do.
So will you be reinfected again one day?
You could.
By an antigenic variant, right?
Yeah, it starts the whole thing all again. There's no permanent immunity, as far as I know, in humans to a reinfection after you've been cured by drugs.
And so this is Africa where some animals are also infected.
In East Africa, almost all of the game animals are infected. Right. In West Africa, almost none of the game animals are infected.
But the tsetses can bite an infected human and pick up more trypanosomes to infect other animals, right?
Correct. That's exactly right.
Can we eradicate this disease?
Ha. In fact, we've tried many, many times. You can't eradicate the vector.
Mm-hmm.
We've
Why not?
Tried, well, because it breeds in the wild.
Okay.
We can't handle that.
So. Can we genetically modify tsetse flies and release them just like mosquitoes?
That's a good idea. In West Africa, it wouldn't work because there are so many of them. But in East Africa, it might be an approach, you know, because, like I said, you had one fly per square mile. And, interestingly enough, tsetse flies lay one egg at a time. They're very, very low reproductive index, but each one is nurtured until it can make it on its own. So these are very nurturing flies.
Very much like people.
Very much like people.
What's the global burden of trypanosomiasis, roughly?
Well, it depends on when you ask that question. If you look back at the turn of the century then, it was very high. But there weren't a lot of people living in Africa then. But now there's billions of people living in Africa. So the burden of infection depends on forced migration patterns and civil unrest and war. Hmm. Basically, it's been eradicated in many places through the use of herd immunity, using sentinel cattle that mm-hmm. you can place around a ring of other cattle that are resistant to the infection. You can try this dummy cow with odor that it gives off from its mm-hmm. quote-unquote mouth to sort of trap all the tsetse flies in East Africa to clear a zone out to raise cattle in. But it's never been eradicated, ever. And it probably never will. So what's happening here is desertification has been occurring in the sub-Saharan Sahel for many, many decades now as climate change has taken over. Yeah. And trypanosomes have pushed northward with their glycina. And there's a band of cattle raising in Africa that's absolutely incredibly dense. It's an amazing small, I mean, from, you know, 300 miles up, it looks pretty small, but it's actually a huge swath of land all the way across sub-Saharan Africa, which that's where you can live and that's where your cattle can live, and mm-hmm. therefore that's where you live. People will actually live in places that their cattle will survive in, that they themselves are susceptible to things like schistosomiasis and malaria. As long as their cattle don't get sick, they think it's okay to live there. And that's it's a sad state of affairs because they've got to eat and they've got to feed their families, and this is what they're doing to do that.
Is there any possibility of making a vaccine?
They've thought about this many, many times. Of course they have. And what would you make it against?
I know, because it varies, right?
You wouldn't certainly pick out the variant antigens now, would you?
No.
That'd be the last
place.
Are
there conserved antigens?
There are, in fact, and there are membrane antigens. If you could get an antibody to the membrane rather than this buffy coat of protein on the surface, you mm-hmm. might be able to kill the organism as it shifts coat from one stage of one antigen to the next. It has to shed the first coat in order to get the second coat to come in. We've tried to think about doing that, but there's no success so far at developing vaccines. So the best approach is to use a general-purpose drug for this. And Suramin, by the way, Suramin, you might have heard of that.
It's an HIV inhibitor, right?
Yeah, it is. What does it inhibit, do you think?
I think it inhibits entry.
It inhibits angiogenesis.
In the trypanosome, you mean?
It's an angiogenic, it's an anti-angiogenic factor. You can actually
prevents the development of blood vessels.
You can use it against tumors. It's actually effective against solid tumors as well.
How about against trichinella?
Nah. Like to see it used against trichinella just to prove concept.
Yeah,
right.
Because tricks induce angiogenesis.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you, Vince.
I think I haven't been listening. Made by my Bayer.
That's right. Suramin, it's an old drug. It's very toxic. The newer drugs, milarsoprol.
It's used against trypanosomes.
Yep.
Helminths.
That's right. Helminths. Which helminth? In this case,
onchocerciasis.
That's right. Suramin is very effective against them because they, too, induce a blood supply around them.
Prostate cancer.
Yeah.
But
that's solid tumor.
The dose per injection is 1 gram.
It's amazing. It's just an amazing, the dosimetry on this thing is incredible. And the therapeutic index isn't that great either.
I think it was investigated for HIV, but it's not effective.
No.
It didn't come up here in my search.
Well, okay, so to make a long story short, and this is a much longer story because there's plenty of genetics to talk about and plenty of ecology to talk about as well.
There's more ecology?
Oh, there's lots. I mean, the breeding sites of each one of these species of Glycina vary mm-hmm. greatly. So to control one doesn't mean you can control all of them because they all select for different places. Mm-hmm. And if you throw a map up of all the distribution species, and if you go to the medical ecology website, you'll see that map. They're all over the place, and they don't overlap much.
Your medical ecology website?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, if that might be a pick of the week. Why wouldn't I pick it? So if you go to that website, and you look up vector-borne infections.
It's not loading, Dixon. You didn't pay your bill. Kidding.
Yeah, it's got to load.
Where do you want
to go to infections, diseases, and then go to vector-borne infections. Yeah, trypanosomes are down there someplace.
Here. Yeah. African.
That's the one. Sure. And then if you go to their maps, you'll see the distribution of the Glossina species. And if you do that...
Where are the maps, Dixon?
Well, they're in there someplace. All these clickables will take you to some maps. And
medical ecology?
Yep, try that one.
The vector?
Try the vector. There it is. There's a picture of the vector, and there's the distribution.
Of the
various species.
Various groups, huh?
Yep. And some of them overlap and some of them don't. It's a very complex...
That's a tsetse fly?
That's a tsetse fly.
Looks like a honeybee to me.
No, that's the honeybees are totally different. If I put them next to each other, you'd see the difference right away.
it's yellow, so...
Arg. Vince is going to post that on the website, folks, so don't worry about it.
The picture?
Yeah,
we will. We also have a life cycle of T. brucei.
That's true.
Here.
Yep.
Which we've been talking about in African trypanosome.
The life cycle of both West and East African trypanosomiasis in humans is the same. Okay, it's very it's similar. It's so similar, in fact, that it confounded Bruce into thinking they were the same.
Yeah.
But they were not the same. They're not the same.
So do you want to reserve the Americans for another time?
Sure.
And we can do a few emails and wrap it up?
Love it.
Anything to say before we leave Africa?
No, except that it's an intractable problem that has risen again as a major health problem because of the civil unrest that's occurring in Africa right now. So at one point there were less than 40,000 cases, and now it's up around 4 million and maybe even more than that. I don't know what WHO is using as a modern quote for how many cases, but it's unestimable because people are being forced to live in areas that they knew they shouldn't live in.
Mm-hmm.
Because of these vectors and the spread of these infections. They knew to stay out.
But do they overlap with malaria?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. We're looking at a developing thunderstorm out of our window here.
Is that what that is?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, thunderhead.
I got a big one.
You'll get wet going home, Dixon.
I'm not going home, Vince. I'm going out to dinner.
Lucky you.
I guess.
All right, let's read a few email.
Sure.
That's it.
That was a very short email.
Eric writes, Doctors Racaniello and Depommier. My name is Eric, and I am an undergraduate at DePaul University, a small liberal arts institution in Greencastle, Indiana.
Right.
Same state as Notre Dame.
There you go. DePaul is a good basketball team, usually.
I'm part of a science research program, but because I don't have the capacity to conduct publication quality research with the resources at DePaul, I've had to look elsewhere to get my laboratory fix. I spent last summer at University of Notre Dame conducting informatics in a toxoplasma lab with Dr. Kristen Hager.
Cool.
And most recently took a semester off campus to spend 40 hours a week in the lab of Dr. David Roos at the University of Pennsylvania. My research thus far has centered around functional and comparative genomics in the apicomplexa.
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 Yep.
But I'm fascinated by all things microbial. Now that I've left UPenn, I really miss the research lectures and the conversations with people in the lab. TWIV and TWIP help fill this void as big names in research don't come to speak at little liberal arts schools. I don't know if we're such big names in research, but we'd sort of like
Mine's
to talk.
Very long.
We'd like to talk. We both have long names, don't we?
That's right. Those are big names.
Anyway, I have a hypothetical procedure for tracking mice and monitoring behavior in infected versus non-infected mice. Do you remember we challenged our listeners?
I did.
So if he's good, you're going to have to send him a What was it, a copy of West Nile Story?
Yep.
There are many different strains of Toxoplasma gondii, but traditionally the toxo community places them in three groups, type 1, 2, and 3. I'm not sure which type of strains are most likely to show up in wild mice, but it would be interesting to see not only if infection changes behavior, but if the behavior is strain-specific. So first I would set up traps and capture wild mice. I would test them for the presence of toxo as well as screen the positive mice for strain type. The different strains are well characterized. Oh, toxodb.org. And we could use PCR and strain-specific primers for the characterization. The key step would be the tracking. One of my best friends is a PhD student in Dr. Gilles Dufield's lab at the University of Notre Dame. The Dufield lab works with Anopheles gambiae. Without ruining Sam's PhD project, I'll just say that the lab has developed what is essentially a nanoparticle-type GPS system.
Wow.
They can tag mosquitoes with a device and then release them into the environment, tracking the mosquito's movement in real time.
I'll be darned.
The hope is that tracking will lead to a better understanding of how mosquitoes interact with their environment so that we can control the spread of malaria and other Anopheles vectored diseases. If this chip can be outfitted to a mosquito, I would bet that I could stick it in a mouse without changing mouse behavior.
I would absolutely agree with you.
Once released, all of the mice could be monitored in real time and behavior shifts should appear as changes in movement. It would not be necessary to try and capture any cats or recapture mice to find data because everything would be digitally tracked. It's cool. This experiment would not help in terms...
Sounds like a book coming his way.
Yeah, this experiment would not help in terms of causation as to why the infection changes behavior, but it would be a great indicator as to whether or not there actually was a change in behavior. Causation falls back to microarrays and analysis of next-gen sequencing, which I am hoping to dive into in grad school next year.
Cool.
Without knowing exactly how the tracking particles work, I can't outline much more of a procedure, but I know the particles exist and the way they will be applied to tropical disease research is pretty amazing. Keep cranking out TWIP and TWIV. I find them at the perfect level of comprehension for an undergraduate lab rat such as myself, and I can't wait to see which parasite is next.
Does he give an address?
No, but Eric, send us your address. We'll send you a copy of West Nile Story.
You just got lucky because you can get a hardcover copy.
Good. And you're going to sign it, right?
Of course.
Next one is from Terry. I absolutely love your podcasts and share both TWIP and TWIV with my microbiology students as well as, when appropriate, my anatomy and physiology students.
Oh, nice.
I have two questions for Dixon.
Okay.
One, in your ongoing malaria discussions, could you elaborate on the relationship between malaria and sickle cell and other such interrelationships?
Oh, sure.
With malaria. I discuss this in both microbiology and during the blood lectures of A and P, anatomy and physiology.
Yes, yes.
Sorry.
Atlantic and Pacific.
Currently only 15 minutes through episode number 10. Forgive me if this is covered already. I don't think we discussed it, did we?
No, we did not.
Would you like to?
Sure. I mean, there are some genetic inherited dyscrasias, blood dyscrasias they're called. Thalassemia is another one of them. And in fact, we just discovered, we actually did cover a little bit about the Duffy blood group, because I know I discussed the distribution of Ovalle versus 5X in West Africa. And Ovalle is a West Africa primarily parasite, which resembles 5X, but infects blood group Duffy negative people. And there are hundreds of different kinds of blood groups out there, as you know, Vince. But this particular one is the receptor for P5X. And so those people that don't have the blood group don't get P5X, but they do get P. ovale instead. So that's one small difference. They wouldn't call it a balanced polymorphism like they would for sickle cell. But sickle cell is definitely one of those balanced polymorphisms, which if you have the double dose of sickle cell, you're going to die, probably. It's a lethal double mutant. Which
can you explain it briefly for those who don't know?
It causes your red cells, the sickle cell, hemoglobin.
It's a mutation, right?
It's a mutation. It's inherited. And if the mother and father gives you a dose of each and you're the unlucky one that gets a double S, small s, your cells sickle very, very rapidly when they lose oxygen. And the sickling causes them to clump up and to block up the capillaries. And as a result, they don't pass through smoothly, and they don't deform in order to go through like a normal red cell would.
Where's the mutation or the amino acid change?
I wish. You can find that out on hemoglobinopathies.org. I'm sure that they have all of them. A hemoglobinopathy, this is one of many, many, many hemoglobinopathies.
Yeah, it's in the hemoglobin.
It's in the globin gene. Portion of it.
The globin portion, yes.
Well, what this does, interestingly enough, in the single dose form, the heterozygote, the big S, little s, is the cells will still sickle under unusually low oxygen tension. But if the parasite infects a sickle cell heterozygote red blood cell, they don't do as well because they need to ingest exogenous ATP in order to carry out part of their life cycle. As the result, there's a reduction in that compound in a sickle cell cell. That is, in a heterozygote sickle cell cell. And this was found out at Rockefeller by the group that developed the in vitro translation system for malaria. When I say in vitro translation, I really meant to say in vitro growth of the parasite. Right. And so by testing out the growth of the parasite with cells of big S, little s, and little s, they could tell why the parasite doesn't do well in those cells. Now, it doesn't matter if the parasites are killed off by little s hemoglobin, because those people are going to die from that disease. Sure, they're not going to die from malaria.
Yeah.
But the people with big S, little s, still kill off the parasite and maintain their normal lives. So that's an example of a balanced polymorphism where parasitism is actually defeated by maintaining this gene in the population.
Sure. Well, it's selected for.
It's selected
because
for.
Of the parasite pressure.
That's correct. Now, it's also thought to be the same thing for thalassemia major and thalassemia minor. But the metabolic nuance of these two entities compared to sickle cell is different. Okay, so there's something different about the parasite's metabolism that's affected by big T, little t, that you wouldn't get in a normal red blood cell. Thalassemia major, of course, is a terrible disease, and people die from it. And so that maintains, that's a tragedy of that maintenance system, just as little s is a tragedy for the sickle cell maintenance system. But Plasmodium falciparum is the parasite which forces the balance in terms of that.
So individuals that are heterozygous are largely in areas with malaria. Otherwise, they wouldn't be maintained.
Well, they were, but now, of course, with African Americans, you've got lots of those people living in areas that don't have malaria, that have no advantage whatsoever about having big S, little S. They still get sickling events, and there's a whole...
Well, wouldn't eventually those be selected against if there's no malaria to keep them?
Not really. There's no reproductive decrease in that group. There would be in the little s, because those people usually don't live long enough to grow up. But the big S, little s people are around all over the place. And so African Americans have a big problem with this.
Okay.
There are other ramifications of that as well. So that's a long answer for your second question.
Are there any other
similar? There are probably lots of them that I'm not aware of. That I don't do research on this. But if we had David Fittick come in to talk about this, I'm sure he could give you a big list. We have an expert here, and we should do that sometime. We should bring him in.
He's right here on the 15th floor.
He's amenable to doing this too, and he's a very personable guy.
Yeah, he would be fabulous. He would love to do this.
We're gonna do it.
Gotta get another headset like yours.
That's right. We'll make it another trip.
All right. And then he says, "Your stories of science history spark tales I heard back in the late 70s and early 80s of my undergraduate days and into grad school. I had some amazingly well-read professors like you." You're well-read, right?
I like to read.
"During my time at Midwestern State and at the University of North Texas."
Oh, yeah.
"Those historical tales always thrilled me, and I love bringing these to life in my own lectures when I can."
Great.
"Do you have any recommendations for books of science history, especially those that are as intriguing as some of the tales you share on TWIP?"
A lot of our picks were those books.
Yeah, check out our lists of picks both on TWIP and TWIP.
That's right.
You can't think of anything currently parasitic?
Every chapter that we've written in our parasitic disease book has an historical presentation to it with references. And if you look at the references, you can get the originals.
And that is parasitic diseases, right?
Right. Which is, believe it or not, still in print.
Many thanks, and please keep up the good work. So Terry is the biology chair at Temple College.
Okay.
And the video tutor at Pearson Publishing. I wonder what that means.
I don't know, but maybe they'll tell us.
Jim writes, Jim is our friend from Virginia.
Okay.
Who writes to TWIP and TWIV. Great TWIP 8, of course. You remember what TWIP 8 was, Dixon?
TWIP 8, tapeworms.
Oh, you're guessing.
I am.
You know, there's one way to find out.
There is.
How would that be, Dixon?
I think you should go online, Vince.
And where would you go?
iTunes. I would go to iTunes, I think.
That's one place. Where else
could you go? I go to microbeworld.org.
Slash
TWIP.
TWIP 8 was frog legs and parasite tails.
Ah, right. Tapeworms. I was right. That's what that's
Additional
about.
Additional listening about the vaccine for malaria in episode 49 of Meet the Scientist by Dr. Erwin Sherman.
He's a great guy. I like him.
It's about 25 minutes long. For your information.
By the way, Erwin Sherman spent some time at Rockefeller with Dr. Traeger trying to grow malaria in vitro.
That's right. Yes, he has a good story. But I've listened to this episode. Very good story.
Ah.
He says, meet the scientists. For your information, just saw a reference to biohacking and saw this site. We talked about biohacking at some point. Mm. And another that indicate a possible trend. Mm. Biohacking.
Mm.
Why does all biology happen in academic or industrial labs? This guy, Matt Cowell, co-founder of Do-It-Yourself Bio, seeks to change that. Okay.
In your basement. Do not try this at home.
And the other one is, let's see what the other biohacking references.
Isn't that where anthrax research started?
All right. The other
I didn't mean to laugh at that. It was a very serious episode.
Then he says, I heard an audio segment about tapeworm infection via cats and dogs that leads to liver cysts and death. That surprised me. I thought tapeworms were confined to the intestines.
Tania crassiceps, I bet they heard about.
So I Googled the topic and see, as in this link, there are several species and primary or intermediary phases and multi-organ infection in some cases. Yep. Please consider this topic for discussion in a future TWIP.
Well, Echinococcus would be one of those, too.
The linked article was authored by a couple of folks in your neck of the woods in case they are willing to participate in that discussion. Let's see who these folks are, and you probably should know them. Oh, dear. We're getting advertisements popping up here.
All kinds of problems.
Tapeworm infestation. This guy's Brooklyn, and this guy's Brooklyn. Yeah, a couple of people from Brooklyn.
Called?
Lisandro Israri and Patricia Fan.
Sorry, I don't know either one.
They're from the Department of Emergency Medicine, Brooklyn Hospital Center. Cestodes, Taenia, Solium, Saginata, Asiatica, Diphyllobothrium, Hymenolepsis, Diplidium, Echinococcus, Spirometra, Taenia, Multiseps. Nice little article here, Dixon. Look.
Nice.
Tapeworm infestation. We'll put a link to this.
Please.
Would you like to read it, Dixon?
It's the pick of our week.
We can make it a pick. We can, yes. That'll be Dixon's pick of the week. Thank you, Jim.
Yep. Well, it's both of our picks then.
Oh, we have like four more emails from Jim. Have diagnostic conditions changed for parasitology from this quote in a 10-year-old text? Quote, this is from Fundamentals of Microbiology, 5th edition, Edward Alcamo, 1997. Quote, diagnostic methods for protozoal diseases have not changed fundamentally for many generations, and the sophisticated devices used for bacterial and viral detection have not yet reached the parasitology laboratory. Cultivation methods for pathogenic protozoa are difficult, and a correct diagnosis often depends on direct observation of tissue specimens, together with a sense of intuition and understanding of the patterns of disease.
Well, over the last 10 years, of course, the PCR reaction has really improved greatly, and the cheapness of the test has made it available in many, many different diagnostic labs. So I think PCR would be an exception to that.
Yeah, PCR is an exception, yeah.
And ELISA, Western blot ELISA, combinations are also available now. And a lot of them are available through CDC. So if you don't have one and you're in hospital, you still want to know the answer, send the specimen down to CDC and they'll be glad to do it for you.
I think in the last 10 years, a lot has changed.
Sure it has. Absolutely.
And he also says, this is still Jim, sent a reference to it and comment about outhouses on piers over lakes by Scandinavian settlers to Prairie Home Companion. Expect to hear about it in an upcoming Lake Wobegon segment. I never listened to that, do you?
Oh, I listen to it all the time. It's a great show.
He sent it. Remember your Scandinavian outhouse story?
Yeah, sure.
Like that, so
sure.
He sent it in.
Sure, sure.
He said, P.S., TWIP 8 was good too, but nothing beats your repartee. TWIP 8 was...
I just read the story.
They like our repartee.
Well, then let's excuse reparting then.
All right,
one more.
Todd in Denver.
Okay.
Hi, guys. I heard you on Futures in Biotech, and just yesterday decided to download all the TWIV and TWIP podcasts and add you to my RSS reader.
Cool.
I'm not in the medical field, but have an intense interest in science and technology, and I have been impressed with your ability to break the information down for the lay people in your previous appearances on Futures in Biotech. So now I'll be getting a regular dose of you directly.
Great. We have the cure.
When my fiance came home last night, I told her about your podcast, and she told me she had just received an email from a friend with ulcerative colitis.
Oh, yes.
The poor woman has suffered terribly with it for years and has found little to control it. In this email, she mentioned that she was considering helminthic therapy. Mentioned it involved parasites, and my fiancé wondered if I had heard of such a thing. I had not. We discussed therapeutic maggots, a topical use, but I was not aware of anything that would be injected or ingested, so I checked online for the answers and decided I should just ask the experts. Any information or opinions I could pass on to our friend would be appreciated. Thanks for your continued work.
There is.
Great work.
Well, yes, in fact, there is helminth therapy available for people suffering from Crohn's disease. Okay, that's a form of ulcerative colitis. Crohn's disease, very specific diagnosis. If you give those people an animal form of whipworm, our own form is Trichuris trichura, the whipworm, okay? That causes disease in people. But there are other forms of this, Trichuris vulpis in dogs and wolves, for instance, and Trichuris ovis in sheep. And there are a couple of other forms of this as well. If you give them those forms of the infection, those species, they will take in the host, but they will not be as pathogenic. And what it does is it redirects the immune system back to its natural targets. Our immune system is absolutely finely honed to respond to invaders in our environment. We know this. And we've evolved throughout 3 million years of hominid evolution in conjunction with our intestinal parasites. Now, you find yourself in a paradise of parasite-free life. Vince, you got any parasites in your house?
Yeah, sure.
Aha. Which ones? What are their names? No, I mean, I'm serious. I mean, if you don't have any parasites in your house, it's because your kids have safe food and water to eat and drink, and your wife too. And so, therefore, we live our lives apart from our natural targets. There are subsets of us whose immune system has to continually take target practice in order to remain finely tuned. What looks like a parasite to us? It turns out that portions of our gut tract share antigenic commonalities with these Trichuris worms. By giving the Trichuris worms to those people only, and not allowing them to reproduce, of course, because these are parasites that are not human in nature, so we give them artificially to people, we then redirect the immune system away from our gut tissue back to the natural targets that we evolved our immune systems for to begin with. So they're actually treating people with Crohn's disease.
This is an approved therapy?
Yeah, it is. You can get IRB approval for this now. But the point of this
is experimental still.
It's almost therapeutic. It's almost accepted because there's no harm, no foul, basically.
So you ingest?
Yeah, you ingest the eggs. They're embryonated. They hatch out in your gut tract and they establish an infection. The problem is that your immune system does eventually overcome this. And when that happens, you can't reestablish it. And as a result, your Crohn's disease comes back. So it's a temporary respite.
These are helminths?
Yeah, yeah.
We haven't spoken of these yet.
We have not.
We shall.
If you wish.
Well, you're the boss.
Well, in terms of medical importance, I've put those in the back burner because I spoke about hookworm. That's major medical importance.
Not really.
But I could.
Yeah, but we haven't done an episode on hookworm.
No, but we should.
Okay. Well, you call the shots, Dixon.
Okay. Well, we're on the protozoans still.
We have other protozoans.
We have Chagas disease to go through, of course, and then Giardia, and then E. histolytica. We've got a lot of good ones waiting out of it. Trichomonas vaginalis.
Can't wait.
Come on.
So we'll go through all the protozoan parasites.
We will. We promise our listeners that we will cover the waterfront, so to speak.
All right. And of course, if you have any stories, you should include them.
I will try my best.
You can find TWIP at microbeworld.org/TWIP. You can find it on iTunes. We're working on getting into Zune. They don't seem to answer too quickly.
No.
But either way, subscribe, leave a comment if it's your first time. Helps us to stay on the front page of the medical podcast directory at iTunes. We're also on sciencepodcasters.org. and promednetwork.com, where you can find other high-quality science podcasts. As always, send us your questions and comments to twip@twiv.tv. Dixon Despommier, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
It couldn't have happened without you.
I deeply appreciate that. I'm not sure how to take it, however.
Take it very well. You can find Dixon, besides here in my office, frequently, in his own office. Right. Find him at medicalecology.org, trichinella.org, and of course, verticalfarm.com. How is the vertical farm?
It's coming along very nicely, Vince.
I hope the best for you.
Thank you. It's not just for me either, but I mean, I hope that the concept takes off, and it has actually. I'll give you an example. Mm-hmm. 7 years ago, there was maybe one or two references on Google when you typed out the term vertical farm. Guess how many there are today, Vince?
How many?
Try and see what you get.
Vertical farm. 6,670,000 results. Wow.
Thank you.
And lots of pictures,
and
too.
If you go to the images, you've got over 1,700,000
Of course, your website is the top hit.
Well, yeah.
Top two hits.
There are others there, too.
Oh, lots of images. 1.5 million images.
Correct.
And Dixon, some of these are awesome.
They are.
They're so futuristic.
They truly are.
Oh, my gosh. You have spawned... And some of these are of you, Dixon.
You call virus.
Why is Sting in one of these pictures?
Because he has actually acquired the rights to the book that I've just produced called The Vertical Farm to make a documentary movie based on the book. So I'm very thrilled at this.
I am amazed that you're here with me.
I'm amazed that I'm here with you. Trust
Holy
me.
Holy cow.
When I show up for TWIV or This Week in Virology, I come in with my dunce cap on.
No, you don't.
Yes, I do.
You're a smart man. Dixon, when's the book coming out?
October 12th.
Excellent.
But you can buy it now on Amazon as a pre-buy. They will send it to you the day it comes out if you'd like.
Excellent. Looking forward to it. Well, I already have a copy, of course.
You do.
I do.
I know you do.
You have been listening to This Week in Parasitism. Thanks for joining us. We will be back soon. Another TWIP is parasitic.